All right, deep divers. We're jumping into Deuteronomy today.
Deuteronomy.
Yeah, and specifically chapter 4, which is kind of like a hinge in the book, right?
Yeah.
You've got those big stories, and then you're moving into the law code.
Exactly.
So we're going to be looking at some fascinating notes that I've got from an academic lecture by Dr. Cynthia Parker.
Oh, very cool.
She is, well, one of the leading scholars on Deuteronomy, so I think this will be really interesting.
Awesome.
And don't worry, you don't need a theology degree to follow along. We're going to pull out the good stuff, the fascinating nuggets.
Right.
But what's really interesting to me is that this chapter, it's like it sets the heartbeat for the whole book, you know? Like there are these themes that come up here that just echo throughout Deuteronomy.
What's fascinating about Deuteronomy 4 is that it acts as a blueprint, laying out these big recurring themes that echo throughout the entire book. It's like the heartbeat of Deuteronomy, setting the rhythm for everything that follows.
I love that, the heartbeat. So what are some of the things, like what's pulsing? What's in this chapter?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that Dr. Parker points out is this idea of Shema, which I'll admit I'm a bit fuzzy on.
Mm.
What is that?
Yeah.
Is it just about listening?
You're right. It's more than just passively listening. Think of it like this.
Yeah.
Have you ever really listened to a piece of advice, like truly absorbed it, and then actually changed your behavior because of it?
Oh.
That's Shema. It's about understanding, internalizing, and taking action.
So it's active listening.
Yes.
Okay.
Taking it to heart and letting it guide your actions.
Yeah, and then acting upon it. And I think that's connected, too, to the idea of remembering.
Okay.
And Dr. Parker points out this contrast in Chapter 4 between do not forget and remember.
Yes.
And I thought that was really interesting. You know, why not just focus on the laws? Why this emphasis on remembering the past?
It's a subtle but powerful distinction. In Deuteronomy 4.9, it says, only be careful and watch yourselves closely so that you do not forget the things your eyes have seen and so that they do not depart from your heart all the days of your life, but teach them to your children and your grandchildren. Then, just a verse later, it shifts to remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb.
Okay, so there's a difference between not forgetting and actively remembering.
Exactly.
Interesting.
It's about grounding their present actions in the story of their past, in the narrative of God's actions and character.
Yeah.
The laws make more sense when you understand where you came from and who you are. It's like understand the why behind the what.
And imagine like just getting a list of rules, right?
Exactly.
Without any context.
It would feel arbitrary.
Arbitrary.
And confusing.
Confusing.
Yeah.
But if you understand the story behind it.
Yes.
The values behind it.
It all clicks.
It all clicks.
Yeah. Think of it like a parent teaching their child to look both ways before crossing the street. The rule itself is important, but the story behind it, the potential danger, the desire to keep the child safe, gives it weight and meaning.
Oh, that's a great example.
Right.
Yeah.
It gives it meaning.
Okay, so remembering their history helps them connect with the deeper purpose behind the law.
Yeah.
Now, another thing that I think is fascinating in Chapter 4 is this whole idea of the Promised Land. And Dr. Parker talks about it as having this sort of Eden-like potential, but also the possibility of exile.
Right.
Just like, you know, Adam and Eve.
The parallel is striking, isn't it?
Yeah.
In both Genesis and Deuteronomy, there's this incredible gift, this place of abundance and potential. But there's also this warning. If you disobey, if you forget the giver and turn away, you risk losing it all.
So they're given this chance to build their own Eden, but they're also given the knowledge that like their choices have consequences.
It highlights this tension between potential and responsibility.
Right.
The Promised Land isn't just handed to them. It's something they have to actively work towards, cultivating and protecting. It hinges on this idea of covenant. A mutual agreement between God and his people.
So it's not just entering a land, it's entering a relationship.
Exactly.
With God, with each other.
Yeah, a relationship that requires trust, obedience, and ongoing commitment.
Ongoing commitment.
Yes.
And it's interesting because Dr. Parker points out that the list of things that the Israelites are warned not to create images of, the sun, moon, stars, it's like a reversal of the creation story in Genesis.
What do you make of that?
Wait, so they're being told not to create images of the things that God created first.
Yeah, it's like a reverse order.
Why? Why would that be?
Yeah.
That's interesting. It seems like this text is really hitting hard on this idea of idols. Is it really that big of a deal? I mean, most of us aren't, you know, building golden calves in our backyards, right?
You're right. Most of us aren't building literal golden calves. But the principle behind idol worship is still very relevant today.
Okay.
Think about it. What are some things in our modern world that people tend to elevate to a godlike status? Things they obsess over, devote their time and energy to, maybe even build their identities around.
Well, I mean, that could be anything, right? Money, success, even social media, fame, maybe even, you know, certain ideologies or political figures.
Absolutely.
You know, we might not be bowing down to statues, but we can definitely get caught up in worshiping things that aren't God.
Exactly. And that's the core issue with idols. They distract us from the true God and distort our understanding of who he is. Deuteronomy is reminding us that only God deserves our ultimate allegiance and worship.
And it's like those idols become a lens through which we see everything else.
Yes.
And it kind of warps our perspective on everything.
And remember, the Israelites had just come out of Egypt, where they were surrounded by idol worship. They were entering a land where the surrounding nations also worshipped idols.
Yeah.
So this warning was extremely relevant to their context.
So this was a constant...
It was a constant temptation.
Temptation.
This pull to conform to what everyone else was doing.
Wow.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder how we resist that today. Those subtle forms of idolatry that creep into our lives.
That's a great question. And it leads us into another powerful image that Dr. Parker highlights. Mm-hmm. The concept of God as a consuming fire.
Okay, a consuming fire. I'm intrigued. We're going to have to unpack that.
Yes.
Listeners, stick with us because this deep dive is about to get even hotter. Okay, so we're back and we're talking about this consuming fire image.
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
It is intense, and that's the point. This image really drives home the idea that God is utterly powerful, holy, and completely other than us. Yeah. We can't contain him or control him. It's a stark contrast to the idols we were just talking about, things we try to make small and manageable.
So this consuming fire image, it's a reminder of his greatness, his transcendence.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, it also kind of makes me think about judgment.
Right.
Like, how do we hold those two things together?
Yeah.
This God who is a consuming fire, powerful, holy, even maybe a little bit scary.
Right.
But also this God who is compassionate and merciful.
Yeah.
And always ready to restore us when we stray.
You've hit on a really important point. The consuming fire image does have that double edge to it. It's a reminder that God is both love and justice. Mm. It's not about picking one or the other.
So maybe the fire represents both?
Yeah.
Like purification and destruction. Like it can refine and cleanse, but it can also burn away anything that isn't pure, that isn't true.
That's a great way to think about it. And it ties back to the idea of exile and restoration that we talked about earlier. Deuteronomy 4 presents this cycle where disobedience can lead to separation from God, but there's always a path back. A way to return and be restored.
So even when that fire burns, it doesn't necessarily completely destroy. There's this possibility of being refined, of coming through the fire, stronger, more aligned with God's will.
Exactly. It's a powerful message of hope. Even when we mess up, even when we face the consequences of our actions, God's love and mercy are always there, waiting for us to turn back to him.
That's good. This kind of reminds me of something else that Dr. Parker mentioned, and she said that once the Israelites are actually in the Promised Land, Deuteronomy becomes less specific about geography and tribal divisions. Why would that be?
That's a fascinating observation, isn't it? It's as though the focus shifts from the physical boundaries and divisions to something more unified, more communal.
So it's like once they're in the land, the emphasis moves from like, this is your territory to this is our land.
Yes.
Shared by all of us. It's about fostering a sense of collective responsibility and shared purpose.
Precisely. It's about recognizing that their well-being is interconnected. They need each other to thrive. And that unity is actually essential for fulfilling their covenant with God.
This makes me think about our world today. We're so divided, so quick to focus on our differences rather than what unites us. It seems like Deuteronomy is offering a counter-narrative, a vision of a society where people prioritize the common good and work together for the flourishing of all.
Absolutely. And Dr. Parker actually points out a specific example of this in Deuteronomy chapter 11. It's a passage that describes the blessings that will come upon the Israelites if they obey God, but it also subtly reinforces this idea of unity.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's the passage about?
It's a beautiful description of the Promised Land, emphasizing its abundance and fertility, talks about rain, crops, livestock, all the things that would have been vital to their survival and prosperity. It even mentions specific geographic regions, like the hill country and the Arabah.
So it's painting this vivid picture of the land.
Yes.
Really setting the scene.
And then it says, "For the land where you are entering to take possession of it is not like the land of Egypt, from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot, like a garden of vegetables. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven."
So they're contrasting the promised land with Egypt,
yeah,
highlighting its dependence on rainfall,
right,
which would have been seen as a gift from God.
Right. And then it says, "It is a land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year." And here's where it gets interesting. Notice how it doesn't mention a specific city.
Oh, you're right. It seems like they're intentionally avoiding naming Jerusalem, even though that would have been the obvious choice, given its significance as the political and religious center of their nation.
Exactly. Jerusalem was the heart of the Israelite nation, the place where the temple would eventually be built. It would have been natural to mention it here. But the text keeps the focus broader, encompassing the entire land and all of its inhabitants.
So by not naming Jerusalem, it's almost like they're saying that God's care and attention aren't limited to one particular place or one group of people.
Yeah.
It extends to the whole land and to everyone who dwells within it.
Precisely. It reinforces this idea of shared responsibility and collective well-being that we were talking about. It's a subtle but powerful message of unity. And it makes you wonder.
It makes you wonder if there are places in our own lives where we're clinging to divisions.
Yeah.
Where we're failing to see the bigger picture, the interconnectedness of it all.
Absolutely.
It's a powerful challenge. And it leads us right into our final segment where we'll wrap up our exploration of Deuteronomy 4 and look ahead to what's coming next. Stay tuned.
Welcome back, Deep Divers. You know, we've been walking through Deuteronomy chapter 4, and it's so clear that this is so much more than just like a list of rules.
It's
like a compass pointing us towards how to live, you know, a life that's aligned with God, a life lived in that Shema that we talked about.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most, striking, vivid images is this idea of God as consuming fire, which I'm still kind of wrestling with, to be honest.
It's powerful, but it also raises some questions. It's meant to evoke awe and a sense of God's power, but it also invites us to think deeply about the nature of God and our relationship with him.
I think that's what I'm grappling with, is how do we hold together this idea of a God who is both this consuming fire, right? Powerful, holy, maybe even a little bit scary, but also this God who is compassionate and merciful.
And always ready to, like, restore us when we mess up.
That's a question that people have been wrestling with for centuries. And Deuteronomy doesn't shy away from that tension. It presents a God who is both just and loving, both demanding and forgiving.
So it's not about choosing one or the other. It's about embracing, like, the fullness of who God is, even the parts that are hard to understand.
Exactly. And I think the consuming fire imagery actually helps us to appreciate the depth of God's love and mercy even more. Because if God is that powerful, that holy, and yet still chooses to be in relationship with us, that's incredibly humbling.
Right. It makes that willingness to forgive us, to restore us, even more amazing.
Yeah. It's like if he can handle fire, he can handle anything we throw at him.
Wow. Yeah.
And it reminds us that our attempts to contain God, to reduce him to something we can control or understand, are ultimately futile. The consuming fire imagery shatters our idols, our limited perspectives, and invites us into a much bigger story.
A story that requires, like, humility and surrender and a willingness to, like, let go of our own little ideas, you know?
But it's also a story of hope and transformation. Because just as fire can refine and purify, God's presence in our lives can burn away the things that hold us back, the things that keep us from experiencing the fullness of his love and purpose.
So as we kind of wrap up our deep dive into Deuteronomy 4, what's the one thing you hope listeners will take away from this? Like, what's the nugget of wisdom that you want to stick?
I would say this. Don't be afraid to wrestle with the tough questions, to embrace the paradox of a God who is both consuming fire and compassionate shepherding. Let the themes of this chapter, the call to Shema, the power of memory, the danger of idolatry, and the hope of restoration, guide your journey through the rest of Deuteronomy. And remember, this ancient text isn't just about following rules. It's about discovering the heart of God and letting his love transform your life.
That's beautiful. And listeners, as we move into the actual law code in our next deep dive, I have a feeling things are about to get really interesting. Who knew laws could be so exciting? Until then, keep diving deep.